Welcome. You're listening to Accelerator Avenue. I'm your host, Bernie Wolford, and our show is being broadcast live from the studios of Business Radio X. Thank you to Alan, our producer, and to all the hosts and staff of Business Radio X who continue to amaze me with how they are using internet radio as an effective business tool. Accelerator Avenue is a show about growing and managing a business through the exciting but challenging acceleration phase. A company at this stage typically has completed their startup, they're out of the garage, and they're ready to scale to the next level of activity. Our guests include founders and owners of companies who are going through this phase, companies who successfully navigated these waters in the past, and providers of goods and services to companies in this acceleration phase. This afternoon, our first guest is Mr. Michael Horton. Michael is a U.S. and European-educated lawyer with over 35 years' experience as a practicing attorney. Michael began his legal career with Sullivan and Cromwell in New York and Paris, then spent 25 years with King and Spalding in Atlanta. At the end of 1999, he retired from King and Spalding to launch Horton CC, a virtual law firm that focuses on the needs of small to medium companies with particular emphasis on entrepreneurial growth companies. And as we do with many of our guests, I'm going to encourage our listeners to go onto the website and read the entirety of Michael's bio, certainly long and certainly impressive. But to continue reading, I would take up time from having the real thing in the studio today. So, Michael, welcome to Accelerator Avenue.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin by giving our listeners a bit of a thumbnail sketch of Horton CC. Tell us a little bit of what that's about and how you are differentiating from some of the more normal, traditional ways of receiving legal counsel.
Horton CC is a virtual firm that caters to entrepreneurial growth companies. And what sets us apart is, first of all, we all have big firm experience. As you mentioned, I spent most of my life with some of the very largest firm in the country. And secondly, we do everything for a fixed fee. Okay. As you know, lawyers typically and virtually always bill by the hour. We do everything for a fixed fee. Because what I found in my past life, I dealt primarily with some of the very largest companies, GE Capital, the Coca-Cola Company, UPS, etc. And, of course, they have a slew of in-house lawyers. When they engage in outside counsel, they're sophisticated purchasers of legal services, so they have an idea of what's going to cost. But these young entrepreneurial growth companies, they don't have in-house counsel. And when they engage an attorney, they feel the same way I feel when I take my car to the mechanics to fix the radiator. I know he's going to bill me by the hour, but I have no clue whether it's supposed to take him 1 hour or 3 hours. So that's really the differentiator, is that we do everything by the hour.
So that is huge.
No, not by the hour, by fixed fee. And there are firms that do things by fixed fee, like an incorporation, you know, things like that. But we do everything. And most of what we do, a negotiated transaction, take, you know, to Garrett's arena, take, for example, an acquisition. We do an acquisition for a fixed fee. And we have no control over how many rounds of negotiations, how many drafts they're going to be. As an example, I have a number of clients that have built around technology developed at Georgia Tech. And I frequently get involved in helping them with negotiating the exclusive license that they receive from Georgia Tech and around which they're building the company. And I closed one here about 4 weeks ago that took 2.5 weeks to close. I closed another one in December that took 13 months.
Wow.
And obviously make no money on the one that took 13 months.
I was going to say, I mean, what an attractive proposition to the client by being able to budget it and know that that's going to be the amount that the invoice is going to be. But then you're taking a bit of a risk that it doesn't become very complex and require twice the hours that you thought.
Right. But see, we've gotten enough experience with it now that basically on the average it works out okay. And again, we stick with it because it's such a differentiator. And there's some really nice features to it, is that, you know, otherwise these clients would often hesitate to call you and share information with you because they know you keep, you know, normally an attorney keeps track of every 6 minutes.
6 minutes, yes.
And so we get to know our clients' business, their business objectives a lot better than we otherwise would, which I think is a win-win situation because it makes our advice more calibrated.
I was going to say, I sense that they are getting much more than what they're getting within the smaller box of just the lawyer, the attorney. They're probably getting a lot of good business experience.
And that's really what led to the founding of the firm, because what separates these entrepreneurial growth companies is that they're growing through the use of outside capital. Right. And if right. they, it's not like a lifestyle business, a restaurant business or what have you, where basically it doesn't matter that you haven't crossed every T or dotted every I. I had had several situations in the late 90s when I was with King & Spalding where clients came in to me for help them with follow-up rounds of financing where I had to decline the representation because they messed up the securities law so badly in the first in the first round. Yeah. That we just couldn't take the take the risk of being associated with the client.
Now your website, on at least one or two very visible occasions, you are highlighting the term virtual. You are a virtual law firm.
Right.
We're not going to find the marble floors and the mahogany walls when they engage Horton CC. Tell us a little bit about how you can in 2011 operate without the traditional, you know, office on the 32nd floor with the marble floors and so forth. How can you turn that into an effective model for the clients?
I mean, it's really, there's so much technology that also aids lawyers, and you don't need to have a library, you don't need to have messengers and paralegals and secretaries. Yeah. And, you know, it's when I retired from King & Spalding, I couldn't even type. And you know, it is so easy these days. It doesn't take long to kind of learn. And then there are all kind of wonderful products like document assembly products, you know, that have web-based applications that you can use to become very, very effective. And that's how we excel, is we try to be extreme. We try to basically commoditize everything we do so we can spit out documents very, very fast. And so we spend a lot of time when we first do something to make sure we get it right. And then we can basically, and that's one nice thing about these emerging growth companies, they go through all the same phases. You know, they have an angel round, a VC round, mezzanine round, et cetera.
I'm assuming that gives you very, very sharp pencils in the marketplace for your services. When you've stripped away so much overhead, I come out of management consulting professional services, so I know that overhead model very, very well. And as a single shingle myself, I'm carrying very little overhead compared to what I used to have to cover with that. And I assume that your clients benefit greatly from reasonable fees because you don't have to put the overhead burden on.
Oh, right. I mean, we are not trying to sell ourselves as being the El Cheapo. That's not what we are trying to do. I mean, what we aspire to do, and I know we do, is we deliver the caliber of services that you would get from one of the big downtown law firms. But we do it at a fixed fee and at a much lower cost.
It's
hard to kind of compare. I mean, make sure you compare apples with apples. But if you take, for example, a typical Series A financing, for example, the going rate in Atlanta is between 10 and 25,000, and we do it for six. So there's a significant savings involved too.
Yeah. Well, let's tell our listeners a little bit about the breadth and depth of the legal services that they might get from you. You've mentioned a little bit about you know, financing and closing. Are you working both the company side as well as the investor side? Mm-hmm. And what else are you able to deliver beyond?
Right. I mean, we basically have, we're not a general service law firm. For example, we don't litigate, just as an example, which is obviously a huge part of what a typical lawyer does or law firm does. All our work is transaction work. And we do a lot of, as I say, four broad categories. We do a lot of entity formation. We get involved when these companies, you know, start out and creating the relationship among the founders. I also do personally a lot of funds, particular hedge funds, get those established. Mm-hmm. So entity formation is one of the things we do. Okay. Then we do financings. I mean, from angel, VC, mezzanine round, lots of financings. And then we do lots of M&A work. And then finally, a lot of commercial contracts. It can be, you know, licensing agreement, value-added reseller agreements, you name it, outsourcing agreement. Those are kind of the four broad areas that we basically get involved with. And one thing I should mention, and this was kind of what led to the founding of the firm, is in a big firm, it's very difficult for somebody like myself who was, you know, a senior partner in a big firm to be involved with these young companies because my rate was just way too high.
Yes,
and then what you do is you push it down to a second or third year lawyer. But the problem is they don't have the deal experience. For example, take a financing, which is so different from doing a financing for the Coca-Cola company where you have investment banking firms. Mm-hmm. When I do help a young company with a financing, I'm also the investment banker. Mm-hmm. So I'm the one part of helping them setting the deal terms, et cetera. And a second-year attorney just can't do that. So that was, it's very hard for the big firms to really provide, you know, solid services, if you know, economically to these young firms. And that was another reason that I kind of like this model, because they basically get a very experienced attorney who not only provides legal advice, but also basically investment banking advice, general kind of hand-holding, consulting, if you will.
Now, a large constituency of our listenership are small companies. Some are launching, some have just launched, some are in that accelerating growth phase we talk about. So let's go within the four walls of your company, Horton CC. You launched in 2000, year 2000. Some of the years between then and now have been pretty lean years due to the recession and so forth. But as somebody starting out on your own, hanging your own shingle, leaving the King and Spalding environment, what were some of your thoughts as you were launching? Was it exciting? You couldn't wait to do it, or you had some trepidations about your staying power? Obviously, here 11 years later, you're here and successful. So just, I guess, share some of your business launch and growth success stories and maybe some mistakes to be avoided with our listeners.
I had a great time at King and Spalding. It was just a very, very different environment. And I basically saw an opportunity in the late 90s when we had this surging entrepreneurial activity with the dot-com companies. Mm-hmm. And again, as I just alluded to earlier, I felt that they needed the King and Spalding quality type advice, a quality advice, but without, as I say, without the marble and mahogany.
Yeah, the billing rates.
So I saw an opportunity there, and that's basically what led to it. And I mean, it's not easy because I had no reputation in this particular space.
Right.
I mean, I'd done a lot of technology work, but it was with big companies, not in the entrepreneurial sector. So I basically left with zero clients. Yeah. And so, I mean, it takes a lot of networking, and I did a lot of networking. And then, you know, obviously I've been around town for a long time, and when people get to know that, you know, what I'm doing, then obviously kind of you get referrals. Mm-hmm. And then as you build a stable of clients, then you, obviously they keep referring other clients to you. So that's the way it's kind of grown. And I find it to be a lot of fun also because we get so close to the clients, and that's what's very satisfying. And we also will take on occasion, for example, right today a negotiating arrangement where we take equity in the client for our services.
Okay. I was going to ask, because even though the fees are quote unquote reasonable compared to, you know, law firm lawyers, still many small companies, the resources are so limited. They need so much. Their resources are so thin. So this is a way of that they are able to engage professional services such as yourself, using, I guess, equity and their stock as the currency at that point.
Right. I mean, but we are very careful. I also happen to be a very active angel investor.
Okay.
So I also actually invest cash in companies that I'm not involved with on the legal side. So I always look at it when I agree to take part of my fee as equity in a client. I look at it as if I'm making an independent angel investment. So I'm very careful. And one of the rules I have, generally speaking, is I don't do it right at the outset. Because then it's almost like throwing darts in the dark, and when I don't know what they're doing, and I make these days, I make all my investments through an angel group where I have the comfort of the number of people with industry experience. They may know that, but because only industry experience is the legal business,
yes.
And so when I invest in a client of mine by basically converting some of the fees to equity, I do it basically on the basis of having worked with a management team, because that's really 70 to 80% of the success factor is what the caliber of the management team. And I get a good feel for where they are. And then I say, send me some warrants, for example. In this particular situation today, it's early enough that I can get founder stock. Mm-hmm. And so, but I'm careful, but I do that.
I like the analogy because it really is not an analogy. If you are trading your time and foregoing fees for stock or warrants, obviously you have to look at that as if it were an investment, because truly it is.
It is. Right.
So the same eyes, the same due diligence. You have to really, really like the people in the business plan.
Right.
Or you're putting a lot of your future compensation at risk. So
right.
The website, your website, is filled with numerous companies and logos, and they're quite varied. Is there a favorite one or two that were just an exciting company, and it was not only good work and good compensation, but truly it was a great service, a great product, and you thoroughly enjoyed being a part of it?
First of all, my website is a little dated. I haven't been in the process of updating it, but there have been a number of really fun situations, and when I think of one, it's always particularly fun when you see that the client is having a nice exit event. And I had a client here about a year ago that had a very, very nice exit event, and that was a particularly satisfying client because I was really kind of the confidant of the CEO. It was a software development company, and they had about 100 ended up having about 100 software developers in Atlanta, but then we had 1,700 in Shanghai and 100 in India, and we ended up getting acquired by Autodesk. But because he was a very, very experienced business person, had several startups on his back, had been an investment, a venture capitalist, but the software, he had nobody else to really chat with on a kind of an intellectual business level.
Yeah.
So I became kind of a real confident, and I went with them to Shanghai on several times. We had board meetings out on the West Coast, and that was a very satisfying and situation. The problem when you work in this space is you end up losing clients if they're successful.
Well,
because you know that's what they're all aiming for, an exit event. These are not lifestyle companies, so so now I no longer represent this company. So,
but it's as we said a few minutes ago. That is, I guess, it overlaps with what I might call business coaching or executive coaching and so forth. Well, you're talking about many things that are outside the legal realm,
exactly,
and of tremendous value to the entrepreneur who, as you say, you may be the only person he trusts to bounce certain ideas off of and so forth. So what a great value.
So that's something that I think, obviously the deals I did in my past life generally were a lot more sophisticated, but I never played that coaching role to the extent, because you had so many specialists involved, investment bankers and other types of consultants that would give strategic advice, investment banking advice, what have you. And now with these smaller deals, you kind of wear many hats, and that's what I enjoy.
Okay.
And you always work with, there's not the filter of an in-house counsel on the client side. You deal that whenever you represent one of the big companies, they have lots of in-house lawyers, and you always you deal with the executives as well, but you always have this filter. And with these young companies, there are no filter. You deal directly with the CEO or COO or whatever.
A lot of my work as a management consultant has been in a similar environment, and I so enjoy making a decision over breakfast, and by 10 o'clock you're implementing it.
Right.
And some of the Fortune 500 clients and my past employers, there were a few more layers to go through, which added a few more months between idea and implementation.
Right.
I truly enjoy that environment as well. Where the client is coming to you, bouncing off ideas, seeking advice, and it goes far outside of the box that maybe was used to get the engagement and frame it. And some of my most enjoyable ones are where my value has been totally outside of what I was engaged to do initially.
Right.
You're experiencing the same thing. Well, you've done quite a lot of international work in your past. Is that a continuing part of your practice? I know we're sitting here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I've been here 17 years, and I've just been blown away with how international our city has become. I believe there are over 60 consulates or trade missions, many bilateral chambers. So is the international work still a part of your practice?
I focus on what you may call the entrepreneurial entrepreneurial community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I still do international work, but it's not my focus.
Okay.
And in terms of networking, I network in what people generally refer to as the technology community. But I still do work for international clients. I mean, today I'm just getting a new engagement from a Norwegian client that's going to establish some U.S. operations in California. Mm-hmm. That came through a intermediary in Chicago. I did here last year. I did nothing to do with technology, but did basically a second acquisition for a large French cheese company. We bought a goat cheese operation in California.
That is great.
And you get it. I had probably the most international deal I've done here in the last 10 years was one where I represented a Shanghai-based company in the negotiation of a big strategic alliance with Dassault in France. Nothing to do with Atlanta, nothing to do with, I mean, it was just, I got it because I had represented a U.S. company that the Shanghai company acquired. And then I dealt with them in those negotiations. And then when they were about to enter into this relationship with the company in Paris, they said, we would like for you to represent us.
Yeah.
So you never know. You get it sometimes. You get deals the strangest way. Oh, but it's not the focus. International is not the focus. The focus is entrepreneurial growth companies.
I'm sitting here smiling and chuckling. We're so inundated with software and with technology and you were in a goat cheese deal. I think that is pretty cool. That's something that I would go in and understand and be relevant to, perhaps. Some of this technology.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're not all. I mean, I also have a company that makes a revolutionary new carpet cleaner. You know, so it's not all kind of high tech.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the fun, isn't it? It's the variety and. I'm assuming that most of your new clients do indeed come from referrals and networking, similar to the story that you just gave. But are there other activities you undertake to get your name in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I really only started when I was with King and Spalding. I would do quite a lot of undertaking quite a number of speaking engagements, and then, you know, only last year did I really kind of begin to speak, and it kind of happened again, kind of just. But it makes sense. I like to have like 5 or 6 canned speeches that I can kind of, you know, play a little with, and have the slides I can use over and over again. But last year I had a client that had attended a big entrepreneurial trade show in Las Vegas, and it's held 6 times a year. Mm-hmm. And the founder of that show really liked my model, my fixed fee model, because he felt, I mean, they're focusing on raising capital, and he felt that they really got gouged by the securities attorneys. Mm-hmm. So basically he invited me to come out and speak. So I spent a total of 16 days in Las Vegas last year just giving, and they're very long presentation to very, so I prepared a lot of good slides that I now kind of use. I gave one last month to ATDC, and I gave another one to a business event that took place in Cobb Galleria. So I like doing speaking engagement. It's also good for, I mean, good promotion to get.
It's great, great visibility.
And then I've started something that may be of interest for your listeners. Is I have something called the Horton CC Office Hour, and where basically people can schedule an appointment with it for 1 hour of free advice.
Okay, that can be. Anybody, you're not restricting that to a certain segment or a certain size company?
No, the ones that kind of would get broadcast to, I mean, no, it doesn't matter. It's usually entrepreneurial growth company,
okay,
very early stage companies.
Okay.
But, you know, I basically give them an hour because I'm in so many events because I'm also an angel investor where you have kind of, you know, angel meet entrepreneur, and I see a lot of entrepreneurial companies, and I see a lot of companies that are, they're all trying to raise money, and so many of them don't do it the correct way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always tell them, you're happy to sign up for my office hour, so to speak. And
what a great opportunity.
That's work. I mean, you know, some of them translate into clients. I just did a term sheet for a new client yesterday that I had met initially through the office hour.
Okay.
So, you know,
I think it's a great idea. Great idea. Well, Michael, before we move on to our second guest, what is the best way for our listeners to reach you? If they've heard something today, they want to follow up with you directly?
Yeah, probably through my email address, which is mhorton and Horton is spelled E-N. A lot of people spell
it O-N. H-O-R-T-E-N.
Okay. Yeah, Horton at HortonCC.com. CC, that's Charlie.
Okay.
It stands for Corporate Counsel. But
Corporate Counsel.
So M. Horton at HortonCC.com.
Okay, very good. Well, I know you're very busy. Thank you for taking time today, and hopefully you can stay with us another 20 minutes or so while we interview our next guest.
Be happy to.
And then we're always hopeful of having 5 or 10 minutes at the end for a bit of a roundtable discussion where I get to sit back and allow my guest to talk. So hopefully we'll be able to do that today. Our next guest is Mr. Gareth Young. Gareth has extensive experience in business and corporate development, finance, and the nuts and bolts of running a business. In 2006, Gareth founded FinanceSight LLC, a professional services firm providing financial and operational services to startups and small businesses, including training, organizational consulting, and assistance with state tax credit. And as we have said with Michael, Gareth's bio is impressive. It is long. So we certainly encourage and invite our listeners to go onto the website and read the entirety of Gareth's very distinguished and very impressive bio. But once again, we have the real thing in the studio, so rather than take up time reading his bio, I'm going to go straight to Gareth. Gareth, welcome to Accelerator Avenue.
Good afternoon.
Let's begin by telling our listeners a little bit about your firm, Abraxas Business Services, which may be a new name for many of our listeners. So who are you guys, and what are your services?
We help people buy and sell businesses. What we do that's a little bit different than most of the folks you'll bump into is we focus really on driving deals to the closing table. So we have folks with broad business background and with real deal experiences managing the transaction process. Most of our clients are first-time buyers or sellers.
So you're working both sides.
We work both sides. Transaction. Both okay. sides of the transaction.
Okay.
Obviously, not in the same deal typically, but both sides
right,
of the transaction.
Right.
Businesses typically with revenues of between about $5 and $30 million, so they're big enough to need some real handholding, some real management through the process.
One question I have always had, and maybe you can shed some light on. If I am a business owner and this is my first time, I'm looking to sell some significant liquidity event, when do I start? I know I shouldn't wait 30 days before I want that to occur. Do I put things in motion 6 months ahead, a year ahead? Is 2 years too early to begin planning this? Is it all over the board? There is no rule?
There's an idea here of an exit strategy. A business owner should have an exit strategy for their business. By default, people have one, and it's called death, which isn't really very, very mm-hmm. smart at all.
Mm-hmm. Pretty predictable.
And the outcome is pretty disastrous because you leave yes. the surviving spouse or an estate with a mess, and things wind down, and all those employees you loved lose their jobs and their families and become sort of impoverished. So it's very sad outcome. When you're a business owner, you should be thinking about an exit strategy from very early on. And if you're thinking about an exit strategy, you're thinking about who you're going to be selling to, how to make sure the knowledge of the business is captured in the business rather than in your head. Those take time to execute. You don't really want to decide, I want to sell my business tomorrow and then figure out how to do that in a couple of months. Those take time. So the best... What I enjoy doing is meeting business owners at a fairly early stage, and much like Michael was describing, just becoming an informal advisor.
Yeah.
So this is just, have lunch, talk with them every couple of months,
right.
and help them start thinking about the things that they should be doing to anticipate an exit so that they're ready when they decide the time is right or when market conditions are right.
I have a theory. There's a Bernie's theory part of every
this
show is our
one
listeners.
Of my favorites is John Cleese's theory. It's thin at one end, thick in the middle, and thin at the other.
There you go. I'd forgotten that. That is good.
So, Bernie's theory.
My theory. Today's theory.
Mm-hmm. And it's mine.
It's the same. Now, I'm gonna make the world simple. I'm going to make it black and white, and there are shades of gray, of course. I'm going to make it black and white. There are businesses that are truly going concerns.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to grow and add customers and maybe do some brand extension or whatever, more employees. I call them sort of going concerns. And then there are those who are being created purposefully for that exit strategy, that liquidity event in year 4 or year five. My theory is there are undeniable significant similarities amongst those two. However, if you are creating a business with the intention of liquidity, selling it in 4 years to 5 years, you're doing a number of things that don't necessarily align with a going concern, as I mm-hmm. have defined it. What, in your mind, what are some of those things that, and let me go on by saying, I think it's so easy to fall into the going concern.
Mm-hmm.
You become reactive, you're putting out fires and so forth, and somebody's almost having to nudge you and remind you, hey, we need to be getting this business ready
right.
for liquidity in four right. or 5 years. So what are some of those little nudges and bumps people should remember?
The biggest single one is it's a mindset. It's not lots of little things. It's a mindset. And the mindset is to look at yourself as a business owner and regard the business as an asset.
In addition to operator, yeah.
Rather than to regard yourself as inside the business as the operator and regard the business as a current cash flow.
Okay.
So if you look at the business from that standpoint, and if you position yourself kind of outside the business operations to look at the business strategically, then you'll be thinking about who are my target customers? How should I position for those customers? What additional products and services should I bring on board? What should I be doing about geographical expansion? How do I incent the salespeople to do exactly what I want? How do I make sure I protect the business from salespeople leaving and taking key customers with them? So you deal with non-competes and non-solicits and all those kind of things. It's the attitude of getting yourself outside the business to have that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore taking the steps to make sure you've got the right people in the business so that you can trust them and you can allow yourself to take that position.
I just get this sense, but both intuitively and from my own experience in this arena, that it's very difficult sometimes for owner-operators to do that, to remember why they created the business.
That's right. It can be very, very
yeah,
difficult because
yeah.
the allure of the business, you get into something and you love it and you want to roll up your sleeves
yeah,
and
yeah.
play with it all day. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, some of the statistics that I have found, I've stolen them from your website.
Well, they must be right.
They must be. Only one in five businesses that are marketed actually sells. That one really captured mm-hmm. me because I think of all the people I know that will try to sell their business.
Oh, yeah.
75 to 85% of asking price is about as good as it gets on the sell side. And something we've already talked about, an average of 8 months to sell. When I put those three statistics together, and I'm sure there are others that we could mention, it's pretty humbling to somebody who thinks they can create something, get it rolling, and in 5 or 6 years, you know, get it liquid and so forth. In many respects, the odds are against them.
Like many things in life, the odds are against the average, but the odds are in favor of somebody who approaches a situation well prepared and with good advisors. So if you as a business owner understand the transaction process, understand what a buyer is going to be looking for in a business, and run your business with that in mind, a lot of those statistics will shift in your favor. If you understand how a business will be valued and you properly price it, and you prepare in advance for it, have a really good process set up, have a really good information memorandum to send out, mm-hmm. you'll do a much better job of holding up on price.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it, and this is where we really try and help
your
clients.
Your value
a lot of it is being really well prepared for the event and then managing the event really well.
Okay. Let me sort of ask the converse of that. In your experience, what are the mistakes you see being made? Perhaps, waiting too late to remember that this business was created for sale. What are some that, you can sort of predictably expect to find?
The most obvious one, I mean, a shocking number of people who decide they want to sell the business are trying to sell a business that's stagnant or in decline.
Yeah.
And they have a strategy problem that they're trying to solve, and they don't know how to deal with it, so they want to sell the business instead. And in my previous corporate life, many of my internal business clients, I was an M&A guy for about 15 years in a large corporation, and many of my internal clients would have operational problems, and they say, I've got this problem, I want to buy a business or sell a business, and I'd spend time with them and help them fix the strategy problem, which was really what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
In deal flow, most of the issues, most of the things that cause price to fall or transactions to fail are either around bad expectations going in, so it's very, very important that we are upfront and honest with our clients and help them understand the process and get decent expectations set about timeframes and values and so forth. And also bad communication during the deal process. Due diligence, for example, should be an exercise of verification, not of discovery. If a buyer comes in and looks at a business and they find something that they don't like, it's not just a valuation issue with that one matter. It raises the whole cloud of suspicion about what else don't I know about?
I wonder what else I've missed,
So those are the two things, and what we think of as very important. Yes, we're deal experts. We do deals extremely well. And the technical execution side of it is something, you know, we pride ourselves, I guess, on doing very well. But the greatest value, I think, that we deliver is expectation management and process management, because you can be the best deal guys in the world, but if you get those wrong, it's not going to be a good outcome.
Sure, and I guess I'm sort of reading between the lines. Many of your clients, this is the first time they're going through this process.
That's right.
You go through it several times every year. So
that's right.
What a great value add that you can bring. Well, let's go on the other side of the table. I understand that Abraxas can represent the buying side in these transactions. Why don't you share with our listeners some of those services that you bring to the market to help the buyer?
A lot of it is around the same set of skills. We are very good at M&A. We do deals very, very well. We've got a lot of business common sense and very well connected, know lots of people and find our ways to good deals. And a lot of it is also then around the expectation management and process management. When buying a business, it's the easiest thing in the world to think, I'm a smart guy, I'm a well-connected business guy, and go with this rather loose form approach of talking to all your friends and going and looking at a business 1 week, and then like a month later somebody introduces you to another. Buying a business, like selling a business, is a lengthy process, and it is best approached as a process with discipline, structure, and some level of formality, and with very strong expectations about how long it will take, the need to sustain lifestyle during that period of time, and therefore having the cash reserves to do that, recognizing the economics and the leverage that one can attain when buying a deal, buying a business, so knowing how much money you can put on the table and how much you can raise and so forth, and then the contingency cushions for the stuff you don't know that's going to happen, and then investing in working capital and that great opportunity that you see just down the road that you want to put money into. So
do you see them, I guess, what we might in romance call a difference between the head and the heart? Do you find the buyer absolutely falling in love with something, but it doesn't make financial sense? But they've got a habit, you know.
And this is where one of the areas where expectation management is so important, because yes, when you buy and operate a business, you have to care about the business and you have to come to care about the people in the business. But you need to, it's really, really important that a buyer approaches the prospect of buying a business as a financial matter. Because you can buy something you really, really love, but if you can't make money doing it, you're not going to be doing it for very long. So that is part of that upfront expectation setting that's so important.
I attribute that, and I'm not a participant at these levels. A few people are, but you know, the numbers we hear bantied about with the Groupons and the Facebooks and the Googles and so forth, that is truly somebody who has just got to have it, because the numbers can't come close to supporting to some of the valuations we hear bantered about in some of these. And to bring it down to our world, I know that same dynamic must happen on a daily, weekly basis. A buyer just has to have it. You know, whatever we need to pay to get that. But, you know, like you say, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months later, you know, it looks quite differently.
Well, we take a very pragmatic and down-to-earth approach to a lot of this, and what we encourage our clients to do and do with our clients is look at businesses that for the most part are pretty mundane. They're not eyeball-driven businesses. They're not businesses with 200% per year revenue growth. They're much more mundane businesses on the buy side. They're businesses which have been solidly run, but probably unimaginatively run. Mm-hmm. So that as a buyer, you step into a platform that is predictable and will give you, with a reasonable level of confidence, a cash flow that you're okay with going forward, for at least for a few years, but where you can clearly see places where there's opportunity to create value by bringing some business acumen that is a level above that currently engaged in the business to bear to improve the sales channels grow geographically and add adjacent products and so forth.
Let me get down in the weeds and let my engineer hat slip on for just a second. Are the numbers totally, you know, overblown, overstated? You know, we all watch multiples of revenue. We all watch multiples of EBITDA and so forth. At the end of the day, it's negotiated. You know, what the buyer will accept, what the seller will offer. Some meeting in the minds between the two,
right,
as if we were making any transaction. Or am I wrong? Are the numbers more relevant in the buy sell transaction?
For the most part, you're right when you talk about Facebook and Google and some of the things that none of us, I don't think, can really understand, because who knows where those are going. But the more everyday kinds of businesses are actually very predictable in their pricing.
Really?
Yeah. Generally businesses are priced as a reasonably predictable multiple of an adjusted historic cash flow number.
Okay.
And there'll be some credit given for very clearly defined upsides. There'll be some credit given for a really robust infrastructure with a strong and solid and stable management team and customer diversity and, you know, other matters like that. But the ranges are usually reasonably tight.
So you sort of know going in what the outcome will be within reason.
Within reasonable bounds. And, you know, that doesn't, if we're representing a seller, that doesn't prevent us from asking for a little bit more.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's usually reasonably predictable. And again, this is part of the upfront expectation management that we have to go through with our clients, because people will approach a transaction with an expectation that a business is worth more than a buyer's likely to see.
I can just see the jaws dropping when you occasionally have to bring reality into a situation. They thought they were worth $30 million, and you're saying, well, it looks like, you know, 20 at most. So.
And at the end of the day, it is driven by numbers, because it is driven, if a business is being purchased by a strategic buyer, they're obviously going to have a fairly disciplined approach to the numbers, and they're going to figure out, they're not going to pay you for what the business can do inside their house. They're going to pay you for what the business is doing today, or for the opportunity cost avoided by the jumpstart of purchasing this particular business, which is all reasonably quantifiable. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a private equity group it's a leveraged transaction. They're obviously going to be all over the numbers.
And if
it's a private buyer of a private business, they're going to be highly influenced by the bank's view of the transaction, because they're going to be borrowing at least a piece of the deal from a commercial bank.
Sure.
And that sets fairly tight boundaries around what the economics can realistically look like.
Let's put some meat on the term strategic buyer. Let's go back to the seller side. I want to sell my business. You're representing me. And I have heard and I have read and people have whispered in my ears, Bernie, you need to find a strategic buyer for your company. I kind of know what that means, and the first thing it means is they're going to pay more. Beyond that very simple definition, how would I go about finding a strategic buyer for my XYZ widget manufacturing company?
Well, if your XYZ widget manufacturing business is actually like a landscaping service, then the odds on you finding a strategic buyer are probably slim to none, because you're going to find somebody who enjoys that kind of business buying it for themselves, right? If you are, I'm sitting in a radio studio here, so if you're somebody who makes some next generation mixing desk, then a strategic buyer might be a Sony. It might be one of the electronics companies, you know, somebody. The label on this box is Behringer. It might be somebody like that. And so the way you would go about finding that strategic buyer is, firstly, clearly focusing your business, and this is the importance of advanced planning, clearly focusing your business in a way that it will be optimally attractive to that group of buyers. So that means you stick to that core product and you don't start doing ancillary services like running radio studios. And then you will engage probably somebody like us to help you properly describe the business, position the business, write the teasers so it can be marketed in an attractive way to those folks, in a confidential manner, but an attractive manner to those folks. Mm-hmm. And then it's not hard to know who the players in the industry are. I mean, there's research, but you can find who those players are. And then, of course, you're going to create a competitive environment by making sure that you're approaching ideally half a dozen of them and whittling it down to two or three who you can work together to get the price up.
Yeah. I'm sitting here flashing back, and I wouldn't have predicted this could be accomplished, but I have seen it, and I'm sure you have seen it, Gareth, where at its founding, the founder can tell you who he's going to sell the company to. And everything they do, and it's one of my most visual, literal examples. I'm former Home Depot, and everyone listening and everyone around the world knows that the Home Depot is an orange painted store. All the racking, the aprons, and all. In some of my international work, I have consulted with big box home improvement retailers. Mm-hmm. Guess what color they painted their racking?
Fancy, right.
And guess what color aprons the people wear? Guess who they are intended to being acquired by? I mean, it's that as visual and so forth. But I have other examples I can give as well. And they actually select their fonts and select their logos of their company so that it's an easy fold into the eventual acquirer. It's
that can be smart. It's also high risk, though, because if you do
if they don't want it
too far down that path, the potential buyer recognizes that they are your only way out.
Yeah.
So you have no leverage in that discussion.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah.
So you've got to make sure that as you position it for your strategic buyer, it's not just for one guy typically.
You'd rather have three people competitively bidding for you.
Right.
But I have
And
chuckled.
It's not just so they're competitively bidding to get the price back, to get the price up. It is so that you genuinely have alternatives, so that if something goes wrong in the discussions, you truly have an alternative, and that means if somebody plays brinksmanship against you, you can stand your ground.
Yeah,
it's very important to be able to do that.
Okay, well, in our remaining time, Gareth, let's get out the crystal ball and tell us a little bit about the Abraxas of the future. 2 years out, 5 years out, 10 years out, more of the same, growing, new locations. Too far out to predict?
Too far out to predict. Fundamentally, we'll be doing the same thing. There is we are just really, really good deal guys.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to do any more than that. We represent people who need strong support, strong advice, and strong leadership in either marketing and selling their businesses and getting a deal to the closing table, or on the flip, understanding the purchase of a business process, going through that process and getting deals to the closing table.
Very good.
That's what we do. That's what we do really well. And we will continue. Our model is to make sure our clients are surrounded by the very best people. So we ensure that our clients are introduced to strong transaction lawyers, strong financial planners, strong CPAs mm-hmm. to round out that team to take them through the transaction, and we manage that process.
Very good.
I don't see that changing. We may scale a little bit. We may expand geographically a little bit, but that model, I think, is going to continue to be the model.
My sense is that activity in all these areas is picking up and picking up at a rapid rate, just from what I can see, what I can read, phone calls I am getting in similar areas. So,
please pass those phone calls to us. No, I absolutely agree with you.
And
it really is picking up.
That is our next question for a listener or two who has heard something that really resonates with them. How can they best contact you and Abraxas?
The best ways are either my email, which is gyoung@abraxas.biz, gyoung@abraxas.biz, or my phone, which is 404...
We never call ourselves, do we?
351-5144.
Very good. Well, once again, Gareth, thank you for taking time out of a busy schedule, for sharing these experiences and services with our listeners. And we're hopeful you can come back again in the future, maybe post-deal and share a success story with someone. Our listeners would enjoy that.
I would love to, and thank you for the opportunity to be
here.
Very
good. Well, Alan, it's better to be lucky than good. We do have a few minutes left on the end. You've got a burning question. I can see the look in your eye. You've got a burning question for either Michael or
Gareth. Just curiosity for Gareth.
Curiosity is good.
Do you get into the franchises? If somebody says, "Hey, I want to do a franchise," do you say, "Oh no, don't do that"?
No, what I will tell them is the reasons why people might find it better to do a franchise rather than buy a business. You can buy an existing franchise,
right?
And there are differences between running a franchise and running your own business. Running a franchise, you will get a lot of support if you buy the right one.
Right.
You'll get a lot of product support. You'll get a lot of marketing support. They'll define the process for you. So for a lot of people, that is necessary and very helpful. But the flip is, for a lot of people, that creates a box, and they want more latitude in being able to expand geographically and being able to redesign products and do things in a different manner that a franchise will not allow you to do.
Yeah, that
so it's horses for courses. It's horses for courses.
I rode around for several weeks on a Snap-on Tools truck thinking I wanted to be the Snap-on Tool Man. Yeah. And when they told me, you know, I said, "Can I go over there and ask this guy?" "Oh, no, you can't. You can only go to these guys over here because these are who we're assigning you."
That's right.
And I was like, "Well, what if I want other clients?" They're like, "Well, you'll have to ask."
Yeah, it's. I think it's almost a buyer's personal DNA makeup. Do they want to truly have their own show and be responsible for their success and failure, and you know all the growth without limitation, or do they want the security of just execute this model, make the French fries this way every time, and here can be your expectations?
So it's the DNA, and it's also part of the skill set. Some people have that richer and broader set of skills that allow them to thrive in that more open field, and some people have sort of a narrower set of skills that are really well tuned to running a franchise, but not to that broader business management.
Well, Michael, let's invite you to come back around the table. Any question or comment you have for Gareth? This is the part that's totally unscripted. You'll hear no more questions from me other than, what do you think our listeners would enjoy hearing beyond what we've already discussed?
No, I would just put in a good word for Abraxas, because I have worked with them on a number of deals, they really do a superb job.
Very
persistent, very professional, and lots of hand-holding.
Thank you, Michael.
It's got to make your job from the legal side so much cleaner and so much more easier when your mutual client has been using the Abraxas service preceding your involvement. I mean, that's just goes without saying, I guess. So it's got to be very, very compatible with what you guys are doing for the clients. So.
And that's what Gareth said. You should surround yourself with other good advisors, whether it be tax advisors, accountants, and lawyers, and, you know, same investment banking firms.
I get the feeling that this time around it's going to be much smarter money, much more selective decisions on where to put money in, and extremely more use of gentlemen such as yourself on the advisory side, sometimes almost demanded by the angel group or the private equity fund or the VCs. We back in 1999, we threw money at things that had no chance of success. We clearly see it now, and we sort of suspected it at the time, but we felt we had to put chips on all the red squares and on all the black squares. For the ones that would hit, we had to be covered. I just sense it's a different game this.
You got a 50-50 chance, you know.
Flip the coin.
Yes. Yeah. When you're flipping the coin.
I mean, the environment obviously has changed. I mean, that was a surreal environment.
It was crazy.
Basically, you get financing on the business plan on a napkin, you know.
Yeah.
And
still in the garage, and your mother wasn't quite sure she was going to renew the contract.
and that's one of the things that we talked a little bit about business valuations, and one of the things that's so difficult with these young companies, you know, you can't really apply kind of investment banking valuation methodology. Yeah. They have no financial. It's often a brand new product. You know, you don't know how their projections, but they're usually like a hockey stick, and there's nothing but guesstimates. And the problem in that space, in the first round of financing, which are primarily individuals or angels, is most angels, unfortunately, are what we kind of pejoratively referred to as FF&Fs, friends, family, and fools.
Yes.
So you see out there, you see, for example, I saw here about a year ago, I saw a company giving a presentation to an angel event I attended. All they had was a patent. It was a good patent they had acquired in Russia. It had no customer, no client. They had already obtained like $3.5 million from angels at a $67 million valuation, which, and it should have been less than three.
Wow!
But so you see all this kind of, because if you look at it, most angels, don't do it habitually. They do it because they get infatuated by the product or have some
relationship. Yeah, they fall in love with
it. Yeah, or have some relationship with the founders. I had a client here that back in November. We raised the first round of $2 million for a kind of really neat kind of medical device. And the company had been kind of taken over by some folks who made a lot of money in real estate and the hospitality industry, and they went to their friends and got basically in a week, they got the $2 million from just six guys at a $33 million valuation. It had no revenues. We were just signed up the first kind of customer in Brazil, but we had not sold anything. And they did have a patent, and I basically told them, the president, and said, you know, if you can raise it, obviously wonderful, because you suffer very little dilution. But this company was one that would need a lot of more follow-up financing. And I said, can you face your friends when they see the next round being a down round, and they're not going to be very happy.
Michael, can you? Along the way, I've spent some time with maybe half a dozen different startup companies in sort of a CFO, COO kind of capacity, and I had dreams like a lot of people do that these things would, you know, fly not just over the fences but out of the stadium and into the sea kind of thing. And along the way, I realized that it was a good job I hadn't given up cash-based business, because my guess was I needed to be involved in maybe 50, 100 of those things before any of them would pay off.
Wow.
So a question for you, Michael, because you've been around the angel world a lot here. What are kind of the statistics around that? I suspect there are people listening to this show who fancy themselves as pickers of those businesses, and you might help them come down to earth a little bit.
You know, I always tell angel investors that it is extremely risky business, extremely risky investment.
This should be the money that you can afford to lose if you do.
Right, and what's very important is that you build a portfolio quickly, because that you need to diversify your risk. And I always tell budging angel investors they should have at least 10 companies in which they have invested, because that reduces the risk. But it is high risk.
Oh, yeah.
But the Angel Capital Association, which is kind of the trade group of all U.S. angel groups, they've gotten a lot of money from the Kauffman Foundation, which has enabled them to do a lot of studies. And they have about 170 angel groups in the U.S. that are members of the Angel Capital Association. And this goes back a few years, but they showed, and I don't know, the average return of angels was basically 27.5% annual return on their investment, which I think is too high. But
that's a pretty good return.
Yeah. It's supposed to be. I mean, it always shows it's better than the VCs. The angels do better than the VCs, experienced angels.
But that's the average return, and I'd be very interested in getting underneath that a little bit and figuring out how much of that was the really sophisticated angels doing a really good job and the FFFs losing their shirts.
And see, this study was just the angel groups. So they're all sophisticated.
So you're already doing
and,
that.
And if you look at, I mean, the angel market in the U.S. is something like seven. It's the size of the VC market. It's huge.
It is huge,
But, and I've not seen any statistics. I saw somebody, and they're probably right, that probably only less than 5% comes from organized angel groups. Mm-hmm. Most angel investment is made by individuals acting individually.
Uncle Marty gave me $100,000 to start my business.
And
for what it's worth, when from the deal side, when I get involved, when people running those kind of businesses come, a lot of those have stalled and they've got to the place where you were talking about, Bernie, and you got 15 friends and family in there, and they've got an operating agreement or a shareholders agreement. It doesn't allow anybody to sneeze without unanimous consent. It's just, it can be just awful.
I know. Well, it's going to be fun, and I'm sort of framing it as this next time around, because I truly do see money that's been on the side coming back in. I see ATDC, which was mentioned. I see it filling up again. I see Cliff Oxford's group, Entrepreneur Advisors, filling up. I mean, we're getting ready for another round, I'm sort of thinking the money's going to be a lot smarter this time through. I hear some people. I heard this several times recently. Actually, some money is only going to go with entrepreneurs who are in their third or fourth time around, even if they may have failed once before, and they've got the scars, which are of value.
That's right.
First question asked by the potential funder is, how many times have you created a company? And that's a new litmus test compared to 1999. If they were still one semester away from graduating, but we liked the idea, we threw money.
So there's a test for some of the folks listening to this who want to start a business. Go hang around a couple. Get your scars before you even try and do it on your own.
I think that's a great nugget. Great nugget.
And there are a lot of investors that will not invest in a first time entrepreneur.
Yes.
And that's just the matter.
It speaks volumes, I think. Well, we must have you both back again, and back with some success stories or some clients to give us a real in-studio live example of some of your work, if you'd be amenable to that at some time in the not-too-distant future.
I'd be delighted, and thanks again.
And thank you for your time. We know it takes time out of your schedule. You have other things to do, so we appreciate you being with us. Thanks again to our listeners for joining us on Accelerator Avenue. Thank you, Alan, for making us sound so good again today. Accelerator Avenue broadcasts two live shows each Friday, one at noon and the second show at 2 p.m., and podcasts are available at all times on the website, acceleratoravenue.businessradiox.com. And while there, please check out all the other great shows on Business Radio X. So until we are together again, this is your host, Bernie Wolford. Have a great weekend, everyone.